Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. We are living in times of huge uncertainty, political upheaval, community violence, environmental distress. In general, we have become hyper-wired and overstimulated and undernourished in all the ways that matter: authentic connection, stillness, healthy nourishment, joyful movement. So how do you cope? Most of us don't have great coping skills and turn instead to addictions, zoning out, or freaking out. Today we'll be discussing a book that offers a range of healthy and easy strategies for getting through tough moments, gaining perspective, and shifting your attitude. Our guest today is Dr. Faith Harper, author of Coping Skills: Tools and Techniques for Everyday Stressful Situations. She's a licensed professional counselor, board supervisor, certified sexologist, and applied clinical nutritionist with a private practice and consulting business in San Antonio, Texas. She's the author of many popular 5-minute therapy zines and books on subjects such as anxiety, depression, adulting, intimacy, anger, and grief, including Un-F Your Brain, The Revolution Will Include Cookies, and This Is Your Brain on Anxiety. She gives you the honest facts on how to deal with whatever you're dealing with, how it affects your body, brain, and even gives us the tough love we didn't know we needed. So hello, Faith, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Thank you for having me today.
It's a pleasure. I really enjoyed your little book. And let me start by asking, what was your perception of the need for a book on coping skills?
Well, the need presented itself. That was what was really interesting, is I had done a small zine on coping skills, and it sold like wildfire. You know, like you mentioned in your intro, we're living in very interesting times, and there is a lot of overwhelm going on, and people really wanted more specific to coping. And when I started researching that, going, is this something that I could expand upon? Because every therapist who writes has written about coping, I realized that there wasn't a really good model that was based on brain science. Coping skills were categorized in ways that were sort of about how the therapist or the theorist perceived the world. And they weren't about how the brain works and then how we react to circumstances based on brain wiring. And so that gave me a chance to kind of correct that gap in the literature.
Okay. Now, in the book you write, I work with so many people who just need more times in their lives to chill. They aren't crazy, they're just exhausted. This seems to be pretty pandemic, doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, one of the first questions I ask people is, how's your sleep? And they kind of look at me like I'm nuts. But that's fundamental to being able to, you know, live through another day and take care of ourselves. I mean, so many medical issues are tied to that. And so I'm always talking to people about the difficult work of self-care, not bubble baths and face masks, but making a budget and going to the dentist and making sure you get 8 hours of sleep and the functional foundational supports that we need so we can deal with everything that we need to deal with in modern culture.
You know, a lot of times terms like depression are referring to some form of mental illness, but it seems to me that a certain amount of depression makes sense given the problems that we're dealing with.
Absolutely. And we know that depression and anxiety can really come from just an exhaustion of the nervous system. There are definitely people that are predisposed to these issues in their lives. But for those of us who are under constant stress, eventually our nervous system responds with what we call depression and what we call anxiety.
Okay. I noticed that your book, I couldn't help but notice, it's full of colorful language.
Yes.
And humor. Why did you take this approach?
That's just how I talk. That's the cool thing about writing for the general public, is if I'm not writing for academia and I'm not writing for SAMHSA, I can write how I speak. And that's how I talk. I like to make things understandable, explaining things in a way that, you know, or were helpful for me to understand them, and to take concepts that we tend to make overcomplicated and simplify them. So I'm not trying to be cutesy or sound like a millennial. I'm middle-aged. I'm, you know, I know how old I am. But I come from, you know, decades of working in community mental health and, you know, running groups, doing individual work, and being able to communicate with people in a language that they understand. And I can talk about and explain concepts like this is what's going on with the amygdala by breaking it down into a common language that we all understand. And I think that's important. And I've had people say, oh, I've read like 20 books on this and now I get it. Thank you.
Now, as you point out in the book, we're all actively seeking ways to manage things that feel unmanageable. Therefore, the need for coping skills. Mm-hmm. In particular, you mention a couple of existential, what you call existential crises.
Yeah.
One of them is the fear of abandonment,
mm-hmm.
or the threat of abandonment. And the other great existential fear is overwhelmment.
Yeah.
You also refer to a thing called anticipatory distress.
Yeah.
And I could really relate to that. You know, you define that as making stuff up to worry about in the future based on what's happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there are some things that we can anticipate that haven't happened in the past, like aging, for instance,
mm-hmm.
or an upcoming surgery. You know, do you have any advice for those kind of problems?
Well, and that's what makes human beings cool, is because the default mode of the brain is the storytelling brain. We're always telling ourselves stories, and we have this opportunity to rehearse situations if we are having to sort of walk ourselves through the story of doing a big public speaking event for the first time, you know, for example, that helps us think about how do I want to do this? How do I want to sound? But because the brain is also wired to negative for survival, it ends up being a lot of times anticipatory distress. We think of all the things that could go wrong instead of thinking about all the possibilities of things going right. And so we have to, you know, remind ourselves that this is one of the cool things about being a human being, is we have the ability to process and think about the future. But because the brain is also going to always sort of gear to the negative as a protective skill, that we are going to have to, at a more conscious level, remind ourselves of the positive possibilities. You know, that what if everything goes wrong? Yes, but what if everything goes right? And, you know, and when I have clients that are kind of wrapped in a cycle of anticipatory distress, I'm saying, okay, so what's the worst possible thing that could happen? What's the best? And what's the most likely? And so we have three scenarios to look at, and that creates a balancing act that gives the brain a little bit of relief from spiraling into really bad anxiety.
Okay. What is a trigger? This word comes up a lot. What does it really mean?
Yeah. And that's kind of one of my little soapboxes that I like to carry around and stand on, is triggers become a word that's been overused. We talk about anyone saying something we don't like as being a trigger, and that's not true. A trigger is a clinical term, and it's a term that really needs to be reserved for individuals who have suffered from pretty severe trauma and still have trauma reactions around that. A trigger is what has the brain go into survival mode, that something in the present triggered their response from the past, triggered a reminder of this traumatic event. So if you were in a terrible car accident, driving down the road that it may have happened on would be a trigger, where you're living in the past rather than living in the present. And so you're operating from your past experience rather than your present experience. So trigger is a very specific term that it's unfortunately become overused to mean anytime I don't like something, I'm being triggered. You know, you don't like it and you're unhappy about it, but that's not the same thing as being triggered.
Okay, but a trigger is an opportunity to bring up these coping skills that you're teaching.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, because what we're doing is, when we know, hey, we're trying to figure out if we have we all have trauma histories, and we all have stuff that can operate it that way. When we start noticing these are the things that operate as triggers for me, here's my chance to kind of get back into my prefrontal cortex and get back in the present moment and use skills that'll keep me operating in the present rather than responding as if I'm still in the past.
Okay, so let's talk about coping and what exactly you mean by it, and how do coping skills work?
Sure. So coping skills are anything that help you deal with the issue at hand. And you've read the book, and I talk about a lot of different ones. Sometimes it's just living through the moment without having an anxiety attack. It can, you know, and there's different levels of coping skills based on what's going on, up to I don't like the way the world's working and I want to do my part in changing the world. So we have a spectrum of I just need to live through this versus I'm really done with all these terrible things that are happening and I want to actually create change. And coping can fall anywhere on the spectrum. And the story that I tell, there was a recent political incident that I knew was going to happen. But even as my husband and I were in the air and as we landed for our layover, you know, the news was announcing that this event had happened. And I had been asked by the local DNC, would I run for office locally? And I'd been saying no. You know, I do lots of advocacy work and it's better having me do that than run for office. And I immediately messaged them and told them that I would run. And my husband laughed. He said it was either that or start a revolutionary army. He saw it coming before I did. But for me, that was the I want to change the world type of coping skill. When I feel that things are out of control and society is not going well, and I maybe can't do something about something that happened at a national level, but I can maybe do more at a local level just by offering to run to the people that have asked me to, that's a coping skill. That made me feel better about feeling out of control about the world.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned a couple of types of coping. I guess you're talking about the internal judo when you're talking about...
Yes.
Yeah. What about mitigate the BS and find the pony?
Yeah. So mitigate the BS is about just having to deal with what's going on and making it as manageable as possible. And finding the pony is, we've all heard about, falling into the pile and finding the pony in the pile of crap. And it's about finding the good in situations. Of course, I took brain science stuff and gave them my own, my own terminology. But the internal judo actually came from my friend Aaron Stapp, who's an MD and one of my co-writers on some projects. And internal judo was actually his term, when he's like that process that we do of the self-talk and how we story our experience. And it's just this internal process. He calls it that internal judo, where we're actually kind of having to fight our own likelihood of thinking in terms of negative. And that's sort of the mind taking over from the brain.
Right. Well, in the book, there's so much, it's so clearly explained, and there's so many examples of different types of coping skills, including those four categories and so much more, and there's no way we can touch on all of those today. But they all involve, it involves an understanding of our three nervous systems, the sympathetic, parasympathetic, and enteric.
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of break those down for us?
Yeah. First of all, I have to apologize. I get really geeky. I love the mind-body connection stuff. And I was really interested in the work on polyvagal theory, the work of Stephen Porges, in how this affects our ability to manage stressors and to cope. And so we know that we have what's called the tense cranial nerve, Nervex, which sounds very sci-fi, but it's the vagus nerve. And we know that it turns on and off based on our perceptions of stress. And so what we're trying to do is keep the parasympathetic nervous system online so we're not going into this fight-flight-freeze mode and responding as if we're in danger. So we're responding from our best selves, our selves that are, connected to other people, and then that nerve actually affects the whole body mind
it affects every major organ. And so if we're aware of that, what's being activated, and these skills helping us keep ourselves settled, then we're having a better bodily response, not just a thinking response.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about thinking responses, and you point out why do coping skills need to target both thoughts and feelings?
Well, because we actually have feelings before we have thoughts. That's really interesting research, and it's something that I think a lot of people aren't aware of. So we have this idea that whatever we're thinking informs our thoughts, and it does. There's a Mobius strip kind of thing going on there.
Now, what are distress tolerance skills for managing feeling thoughts?
So distress tolerance skills, the term comes from what's called dialectical behavioral therapy, the work of Marsha Linehan and others. And she talked about it was a form of cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's really become its own thing. But she found that with people who had some of us are just wired to be more emotional. We feel things more strongly and more deeply than others. And that was what her work was on, is when you feel things more strongly and deeply, how do you manage that when these feelings are really awful? She was specifically working with individuals who had borderline personality disorder, and it's been used for many, many other people since then. But people specifically with borderline personality disorder often are walking around the world like with no skin on the body. They feel everything in this very raw way. And she found that, managing the distress of being so raw all the time was a very helpful skill. So instead of being reactive to everything going on, people were able to be proactive by managing the distress of being raw rather than reacting from it. And then they could be proactive in their responses once they were able to resettle their nervous systems and manage what they were feeling.
I love the way that you borrow from other disciplines. One of the examples is the Navy SEALs, and you talk about the four pillars of mental toughness.
Yes. And I love that. We're like, what's the one big thing? And I'm like, well, let's look at who's been studying this the most. Who needs to be in charge of their physiology more than anyone else? Navy SEALs. And, the research shows that it wasn't about physical toughness that got people through Navy SEAL training. It was a mental toughness. And, the research is out there about what those pillars are. And they're really good skills for everybody to be able to use. Being able to handle things is really not about our physicality. It's about our ability to manage the nervous system in our own thoughts and emotions.
Mm-hmm. And so there's four pillars, and the first one is very short term and very specific goal setting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good one to explain.
Yeah. So your listeners know, we actually had to reschedule this interview because I had to go in for surgery. And so I'm home on bed rest. But when you come out of surgery and you hurt and you're disoriented and all these fun things, and the goal is I need to breathe through waiting for my pain meds to kick in. I need to, wait until I get, I'm able to eat again. And these very short, I'm just going to breathe until all these things pass, and creating these little windows of, I'm just going to get to this. I'm not worried about getting home in 2 days. I'm worried about getting to a place where it's not hurting so bad, where I can sit up again, in 2 hours, they're going to, let me actually go to the bathroom and have something to eat. And having these very specific goals are very helpful for the process, rather than looking at, I'm not even going to get to go home for 2 days, and that's, horrible. And sometimes we need to take it step by step. For people in recovery, sometimes you have to not drink, not use, not engage in an addictive behavior a minute at a time. I'm going to not use for the next 5 minutes. I'm not going to not use for the next 50 years, but I'm going to sit here and not use for the next minute. And we need to do that with everything, any kind of big project that we have at work. And breaking things down into those manageable chunks, gives our brain something to work on and something to look forward to.
Now, the second pillar is positive mental visualization. I'm sure this played into your personal example of having surgery too.
Oh, absolutely. Of being able to create, because we're storytelling creatures, to be able to create a story of that positive outcome of, hey, I want to be able to get up and use the bathroom by myself so I can go home and, you know, seeing our recovery or seeing our success versus getting into this cycle of anticipatory distress by focusing on what's the best possible outcome here. And I've had clients find that very, very helpful to actually maybe journal out the best possible outcome for their situation. And it's a positive visualization exercise.
Uh-huh. That sounds very helpful. And then the third pillar is positive self-talk. I think we all know about that. And then the fourth pillar, managing self-arousal. Let's talk about that.
And that goes back into the sympathetic versus parasympathetic nervous system again, is that we are trying to keep our parasympathetic nervous system online, which that's the rest and digest versus fight and flight, that we want to be as calm as possible, because the minute our sympathetic nervous system gets engaged, we're less likely to use our thinking brain. And they found the same thing, that this is stuff that came up in polyvagal theory, and this is stuff that, you know, Navy research has found as well. And so, and when I'm working, I live in Military City, USA, so I have a lot of clients that are military, you know, police officers, sheriff's department, and the like.
Uh-huh. You know, you make a big point in the book about practice and why it's important to practice coping skills.
Yeah. And I mean, there's something that comes from acceptance and commitment therapy. They turn it on its head and they said, come up with a little story about how wrong it's going to go if you're very spun up on this, but then sing it, because you can't get wrapped up in that story if you're singing it at the same time, which is kind of a brilliant way of, like, if you're in this anticipatory distress cycle, create a phrase for it, but then sing it rather than spin on it. And so there's all these little tricks that we know now, because of, we know so much more about how the brain works, that helps us kind of reset our emotionality so we are using our prefrontal cortex the best ways we can.
What is this thing called paradoxical intention?
Oh, and that's brilliant. And that actually comes from the work of Viktor Frankl. If anyone's not read The Man's Search for Meaning, I think it's one of those books that everyone should read just because we're human beings. He was in the concentration camps. He survived the concentration camps, and he came up with a form of therapy called logotherapy, you know, having meaning. And paradoxical intention was this idea of, it was one of those things that it's almost humorous, this idea of kind of brick rolling our own brains by this opposite response. And he used to do things like, if people were afraid of balloons, he would just go bring them into a room full of balloons. And, you know, you kind of get over the overwhelm, and pretty soon you're popping all these balloons with glee. And so it was this idea of this doing the opposite to overcome the fear.
Right. If you intentionally invoke what's causing so much anxiety, it loses its power, you write in the book.
Sometimes, and for some people, it's overwhelming, but it's prolonged exposure kind of uses the same ideas of, you know, building exposure to things that cause issue for us. But it comes from his work, and, you know, the point of having a human life is this meaning-making system. And that was one of the things that he was using, you know, back in the 50s even,
right,
to help overcome fears by pushing themselves through it. You know, this idea that your nervous system's going to only handle so much overwhelmment before it's going to go, oh, it's just balloons, it's not a big deal.
Right. Yeah, no, his book, Man's Search for Meaning, is an epic, it's a classic. I agree with you. Everybody should read that. Well, you know, there's so much more we could explore. There's so much more in your book. You've got this whole long catalog of different coping skills. And you explain them so well, and you put them in the categories. And I wish we had more time, Faith, but we have basically run out of time today. And I want to make sure to tell our listeners about your website before we go, which is www.faithgharper.com. It's Faith G. Harper, is one word. And thank you very much for being on the show today, Faith.
Thank you so much for having me. I had fun geeking out about brain research.
You're really good at it. And for those who tuned in to the Pathways show late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we've been visiting with Dr. Faith Harper, author of the new book, Coping Skills, Tools and Techniques for Every Stressful Situation. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed via KBOO.fm Sunday mornings at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Faith Harper and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.